Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
Hey, everybody, welcome in. Here comes another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. I'm David Summers, and this is the story of wrestling in America as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now, let's step back into the ring and back into time. Let's get wall-to-wall, tree-top tall, with the Tennessee stud, Ron Fuller, in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee. All right, Ron, you would be considered one of the big men in the business. You're 6'9", 265 in your big day way back when. You might you think you've shrunk by an inch by now?
I don't know, man. I think I'm still up there pretty close to it, at least.
I think so. Hey, but sadly, we lost one of the big men in the business. And that was a lot of folks, I guess you would say, would know him by Sid Vicious. Sid Udy died at the age of 63.
Right, man. And what a sad thing. Rob managed him for many, many years. He's one of the first guys that Rob managed when he went to WCW. Wow, Sid was an amazing talent and certainly a big dude, man. Had a heck of a body, kind of crazy. You know, you didn't know where Sid was a lot of times, but mentally, you know, but great athlete, great, great wrestler.
Charlie Platt called me yesterday and we talked about him for a few minutes and you mentioned crazy. And I know that's with a lot of respect because he had some issues, maybe, I guess you would say, but they say he was one of the nicest guys ever. And Charlie actually told me a brief story about a locker room incident, and we kind of had a laugh over that as we were remembering Big Sid, no doubt about it. All right, so listen, stud, things are rocking for your studcast. 2 weeks ago, you broke an all-time record for listeners, and your Kevin Sullivan tribute was absolutely amazing. The history between the two of you was really special, no doubt about it.
Well, he was a special talent, man, and a special person, though. You know, and I'm in the process. It's amazing here. We're talking about Sid and we, you know, and then Kevin just passed a few days prior to that. Wow, it's just how fast they're going. It's, you know, and I'm in the process basically of working on two projects that I think Kevin would have been proud of, actually. And both are for my fans. And then I hope to soon be making an announcement on both of these projects I'm working on. I've got some things going and some ideas that I have never done before, and looking forward to seeing how much of this I can get done.
Wow. Okay. Listen, I'm already kind of in shock at how much you're doing already and have been doing for years now. I think you started after being totally away from the sport for like 28 years by creating just a website, TNStud.com, about 7 years ago when you set that up. Then came Studcast, and I remember you talking about these before their inception. We were hanging out on the back porch looking out into the woods, and you said, I think I want to start this thing. And I thought, okay, that's cool. That would be interesting to see how far it goes, and it's unbelievable how far it goes. So, of course, then came along the Studcast, an amazing 300, this is number 363 of them, 43 classic super studcast where you actually talk to so many superstars. Now, 4 social media sites, a YouTube channel, Southeastern Rewind on YouTube, and you're now making public appearances. I don't know how you keep up with all this.
I don't know, man. I got back into a hornet's nest, I think, Dave. You know, a lot of activity. And, you know, when you put it like that, man, it sounds pretty significant. I never realized, but there's quite a few things there. I have to admit, I enjoyed what I do, and it seems my fans also enjoy it. And so my style of wrestling podcast is kind of unique. It's about one family. As you say, at the opening every week, more than 100 years ago, we started. And we're four generations. And basically, I'm telling the history of not only that family, but how the sport works as well along with it. So there's nothing out there like it. My studcast is pretty unique.
Yeah, absolutely unique. So speaking of telling the history of sport, give us an idea of where we're going to be riding today, Stud.
Well, this studcast is going to be a great example of what I just mentioned, I think. We're going to find out why I would want to have two TV stations broadcasting my TV show in Birmingham, which we haven't talked about in a while. Birmingham is going to open up in a couple of months past where we are now. And I had two stations in Birmingham, and that was very unusual to have that type of setup. Then we're going to go north of there. Obviously, we're going to go back into Tennessee. We're going to talk about the new Southeastern owner's next card there, which is going to be in the second week of August, 1980. And we'll be taking a close look at why and who was on the card, and we'll break it down for everybody like we have been doing lately. And then we're going to ride south, back down to Southeastern Gulf Coast Territory, Pensacola, Florida. And for a card there, and that's going to be the same week, the second week of August, 1980, as we're going to be talking about in Tennessee. We'll talk about the TV promoting that card, the results of the card, the attendances, and all three of the major markets. And then I'm going to tell a few more stories about my great friend, Kevin Sullivan. Mm-hmm. We kind of talked about this the last couple of episodes. You know, kind of keep his memory alive a little longer, and then maybe after that we might even have time for a learning tree. If we have time, that would be great.
Oh, absolutely, and I think you're so right, because we lose a great one like Kevin Sullivan or Big Sid, and they tend to get a tribute that lasts maybe a day, and then we forget about them. And I think that's cool that you do the best you can to keep these memories alive. So if I counted correctly, that's four different subjects in about an hour that we're going to hit on today. I know you're good at cramming a lot of history into a small amount of time, but I have real doubts about you getting all of these in one studcast. So if you're out riding the road and you're listening to this studcast, hold on tight, because we got a lot coming at you. The only way to find out, I guess, is by getting started, like, say, right now. So you want to start in Birmingham, Alabama. Let's go to Birmingham and tell us why you decided you needed to have two TV stations in the same city.
Okay, that works for me, Dave. Let's get right into it, man. There were several reasons to believe that just one TV station showing our TV in by far the biggest city we had ever run in Birmingham, Alabama, might not be enough to make a success out of it. And there were several reasons, and I want to get into those reasons. They make sense as we talk about it. I think fans will understand this. So let's start with the fact that Birmingham didn't have a live wrestling match in more than a year after we bought it. Prior to us buying it, there was no matches for about 6 months. And before we're going to have our first match, was going to be another 6 months. So, that was more than a year. And the last one that they had, they drew 100 people in Botwell Auditorium. That's a building that held 7,000.
Wow.
So imagine what that looked like.
Wow. Right?
So Nick Gulas, who was my grandfather Roy's former business partner, he had sold the city previously, prior to us buying it, to someone in 1979, after his son George Gulas had basically destroyed Nick's entire territory. Nick's last couple of shows there before that sale weren't much bigger than that show that the new guy ran. He ran one show and had 100 people there in Boutwell. And I guess he figured out real quick, wow, this is a dead wrestling city. And that's basically what Birmingham was when we bought it. So my partners and I knew that, though. But I'd already bought out two wrestling companies over the last 6 years. I started out in Tennessee, and I bought a territory. It wasn't a territory. It was just a town, Knoxville, basically. And that one was in bad shape. It wasn't in good shape. It was not drawing big, big money. And then in 1978, 4 years after I bought Knoxville, I got involved in down there in the Gulf Coast territory with my relatives, the Fields brothers. I bought them out. And I'd made a tremendous success out of both of them. And I was pretty sure that we could do it again in Birmingham. I really felt like we had a good shot to make it happen again. And I'd already made a deal with Nick's old Birmingham TV station back in May of 1980. When we purchased Birmingham and northern Alabama, northern part of Alabama, and we had already been airing our Dothan-produced Southeastern TV show on that TV station. That's WBMG, Channel 42. We'd been airing this show there for 3 months at this point that we're talking about. And I had a deal to include them on a huge billboard buy with the Lamar Outdoor Advertising, and that was going to begin in the middle of September in 1980. So our Birmingham TV station had a pretty good signal, but channel number 42 indicates right there that it's a UHF TV channel. And it's definitely not a major national affiliate of like ABC, CBS, or the NBC network. It's a local channel, I guess is a good way to put it. And I heard a rumor in August of 1980 that somebody somewhere was talking about trying to get on the biggest and strongest TV station in that part of the country, WBRC, Channel 6 in Birmingham. They were probably, they got on there, going to put their wrestling show on the air. Well, you know, as soon as I heard that, I couldn't allow that. We had already bought the town, and we certainly didn't want to have competition right off the bat. And so, you know, it would have destroyed our plans to make a huge success out of Birmingham, which was the biggest city we had ever owned.
Wow. I mean, that's crazy, Ron. The WBRC Channel 6 signal, that signal had to be way more powerful than, say, WBMG Channel 42 signal, which I'm guessing is probably cable-based.
Yes. And that basically cable was kind of in its infancy in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
So there were about 6 or 8 channels that you could get in Birmingham. BRC was the hoss. I mean, it was a monster station. And it was a great comparison. Let's make a comparison to Knoxville station. When I bought Knoxville, we were on the guy was on the UHF TV channel 26 in Knoxville. Signal only went out about 40 miles outside of Knoxville. And I'd have never been able to turn that town into a territory with the signal that only went out 40 miles. So I went to the biggest TV station in Knoxville, WBIR, which was a CBS affiliate station. And that signal was so strong, Dave, it went out some places as far as 150 miles north of Knoxville into Kentucky. And when I got on that station, it helped me to create the best little territory in the world. But that station was so strong, it was one of the reasons it happened.
Yeah, this is really fascinating, Ron, as always. So what happened with the big TV station in Birmingham? I mean, did you make it? Did you get on it?
Yes, we did. And its signal, wow. It was just like the BIR in Tennessee. Its signal reached east into Georgia and west into Mississippi, and north almost into Tennessee. It was the strongest TV station in Alabama. And with that kind of coverage, we already had down south, which was Mobile and Montgomery and Dothan stations in those areas. We had the entire state of Alabama locked up, man, for Southeastern wrestling.
Wow, no doubt about it. I love these studcasts. I mean, you never know where we're going to be headed and what we're going to learn when we get there. All right, so if you are ready, let's set up the card for the Southeastern owners in the Tennessee territory that were moving back into the Knoxville Coliseum on Thursday, August 14th, 1980. Take us back in time on that one, Stud.
Okay, so, well, for the first time in their newspaper ad, they had five matches. It was the first time I'd seen five matches. They were always four, and then they would say an additional match or whatever, sometimes three matches and two extra matches or whatever. But this time they put in five matches, and they had two new names on these five matches. First-timer from the week before was Steven Regal, and he was going to be facing a new guy. He was making his first Knoxville appearance, Stan Lane, quite a talented young guy. He's going to be with us in Southeastern within a year. In the second match, Terry Taylor was going to be wrestling against Dennis Condrey. The third match was another newcomer, a guy named Ernie Holmes, wrestling against Baron Von Raske. The fourth match was a Southeastern Tag Championship match, Mr. Wrestling 2. Again, he has a new partner, right? I mean, why not, right? I don't know how this keeps happening, but it did. This time is going to be Steve Kern, who is going to be the fourth partner for Wrestling 2 in five tag matches that he had had against the Assassins, the Champion Assassins. Then in the main event, you had Abdullah the Butcher, who was going to be seconded by, of all people, Kevin Sullivan, and facing Maniac Mark Lewin, who was seconded by the great Mephisto, Frankie Kane.
All right, so at least they had five matches advertised in the newspaper ad for this card. I mean, so what did you think about it and the layout for this show?
Well, I thought, you know, two of the first three matches meant absolutely nothing, basically, as a support for the top two matches. Stan Lane and Ernie Holmes were in the first and the third matches. It was their first time there. People obviously didn't even know these two guys at all. Ernie Holmes was wrestling against the champion, their champion, Baron Von Raske. So Stan Lane now was a very good wrestler, as I mentioned, but then he was going to be needed on every card for a few weeks at least before he was going to be helpful in drawing the money. Takes a while for a guy to get over, yet people have to see him two, three, four, five times. The more they see him, the more they like him. And they'd start to draw you money, but it takes 4 or 5 weeks for that to happen. And I'd never even heard of this guy named Ernie Holmes, not then and to this very day. I don't know who Ernie Holmes even was. So, you know, I didn't know he was a wrestler. So I'm sure, you know, out of these matches, the first three matches, I'm sure that Terry Taylor and Dennis Condrey had a heck of a match, you know. Although Taylor had been on three cards and only three cards in 3 months, he was a great wrestler, and so was Dennis Condrey. Dennis Condrey was reaching his prime at this point. And if only believed that at least three angles on one card, if he only had done that type of thing like we were trying to do, sometimes we had as many as five angles on a card. If only had just gone to three angles on the card, that combination right there, Dennis Condrey against Terry Taylor, that would have been a great one to build on for that third angle. So the Mr. Wrestling 2 and various partner matches, let's discuss that a little bit. Ole kept having on every card that would have made more sense and probably drew more people if he had brought back Stan Hansen as Mr. Wrestling 2's partner. But for the third time in a row, that would have been three matches in a row with Wrestling 2 and Stan Hansen against the Assassins. Instead, he throws in a new guy again. And they had a cage match. Then they went back and they had a basic tag match, Wrestling 2 and Stan Hansen. And now they're going to have a championship match. And they don't bring Hansen back. They put Steve Kern into the program. So, again, you know, if Ole was here, I'd have to say, what were you thinking about, Ole? I mean, how did this make any sense? So I really don't understand the part in the main event that really, really knocks me out is why would they have Abdullah the Butcher replace Kevin, who was wrestling in the main event the week before against Mark Lewin? Now they put Abdullah the Butcher, and he's a heel. Kevin is a babyface. They take Kevin out of the match. They put Abdullah in there against Maniac Mark Lewin. They make Kevin a second to a heel, and they put the Great Mephisto as a second to Mark Lewin. And Mark Lewin's didn't even have a manager. So, you know, it's like, man, you know, and if I didn't know better, you know, I would think Ole was maybe trying to kill the Southeastern Territory so that his Georgia crew wouldn't have to drive that long trip up into Tennessee.
Wow.
You know, and especially after the rainout that they had the week before. I know they had a bad situation as a result of that, for darn sure.
Wow, it makes me wonder. I mean, I think you could be onto something there, but it makes me wonder what kind of money those guys would make for making that drive and going up there and doing those shows and making it worthwhile. So, I mean, do you really think that? I mean, that could have been true, that he was kind of trying to just dump out of the whole thing. But, I mean, to me, that Georgia owner's booker could be intentionally trying to stop sending wrestlers into Tennessee. Wow.
I know that's pretty far out there, but, you know, I said in the last Cousins podcast that I was sure the promoters and even more so Ole, the booker, was going to get a lot of flack as soon as these guys got back home after wrestling in the rain and having a crowd of less than 1,000 people and knowing that they couldn't pay them big payoffs. That I knew that this was going to be a problem for him, a big problem for him. And so Knoxville was just in a mess. They couldn't get anything to work for him.
Wow. I love these breakdowns that you're doing on each show about the Southeastern Tennessee cards. It's so interesting getting a look on the inside at what the sport was all about. So how about before we take our break, which is coming up soon, can you tell us who was on the Southeastern Gulf Coast card? And let's go to the second week in August of 1980.
Okay, so we're back down south. This one was another great card, man. Had two tag team matches on it. The opening match could have been a main event in just about any city in the country. The opening match was Norvell Austin against Sweet Brown Sugar. I mean, wow, what a match those guys were going to have. And the second one was Ricky Gibson facing for the first time ever in his career, Plowboy Frazier, who was seconded by Floyd. The third match was a return match from the week before, which ended in a 20-minute time limit draw. Charlie Cook was wrestling against a newcomer named Tom Stanton. And they wrestled to a 20-minute time limit draw. I watched that match. I liked it so well that I brought it back. They were going to wrestle again the following week in a 30-minute time limit match because it was such a good match. And normally you don't get that when you have a guy's first time in a town. So this kid Stanton, he had some go in him, and he was going to help us. So for the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship, the winner was going to end up facing the World Heavyweight Champion, the World Junior Heavyweight Champion, I should say, Les Thornton, the following week. And that was going to be Tony Charles wrestling against Jerry Stubbs, who was the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion. Always the champion had a shot at the world champion if you had a local champion. And that was what was going to happen for the next week. The first of the two tag team matches on this card was a special tag. It was with Rob and I against the Mongolian Stomper and the Big C. And the main event was for the Southeastern Tag Championship. Joe LeDuc and Bob Armstrong were going to be facing the new champions, Ron Bass and Randy Rose, managed by the Big C.
That's a really good card right there. Two championship matches, a special challenge tag match, and a 30-minute time limit match. All right, folks, when we return, we're going to find out who and what was on the next TV show. That's coming up when this Studcast continues. Okay, Studcast fans, Ron is taking a quick break. He's stepping over to the refrigerator to get a little bit of refreshment. And I think this is a good time to say congratulations. And they're definitely in order for Ron. I don't want to embarrass him in front of him. But the next Studcast, number 364, is going to make exactly 7 years from the very first one that he's been doing this, these phenomenal Studcasts. We're talking 7 years on the next Studcast. So it's going to be one that you can't miss. I'm sure he's not going to admit it or maybe even be aware of it, but it could quite possibly be some kind of record for wrestling podcasts around the world. I'm talking. Fans have no idea how hard he works every week and how long it takes to put each episode together. I occasionally hear from him and I'll say, hey, how's it coming? Well, I'm about halfway done. So listen, I know how he studies this. He tries to get the facts as accurate as possible. 7 years doing a weekly podcast and having missed less than 5 episodes during that time. It has to be a record in and of itself. And I know one of the times that he missed an episode was because his mom passed away. So listen, feel free to send him your congratulations. I think that would be a really cool thing to do on any of Ron's social media sites. If you would like, do that. And I know Ron would be very happy to get your note. He loves to respond to every one of those. So do that if you have an opportunity. All right. It's become part of our lives every week. I know it's a part of mine and I know how much you love them too. Imagine how you would feel if you missed it. Don't miss it. Next week, episode number 364 will mark 7 years exactly for the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, who just walked back into the room. All right, the Stud is back in his seat. Let's get right back to it. And Stud, it is time to break down the Southeastern TV show on Saturday, August 9th, 1980. It was going to be promoting the matches the following week, for the following week, which was the second week in August of 1980. Set that up for us.
Well, the last Studcast began with the end, basically, of the Southeastern Tag Championship match, which was in that month, the rating period month, and it was the last championship match of that month, and that was the TV before this. So when Ron Bass and Randy Rose won the tag belts from Rob and I in that match, we joined Charlie at the set to open this TV show with the results of literally our first and last chance to win our Southeastern tag belts back.
Okay, so as I remember, the past week, you and Robert were getting your first opportunity to regain the belts, but the Big C had somehow talked Commissioner Don Curtis into making that match both a return match and a last shot match at the same time. So if you didn't win, you never got another shot at the champions.
Yeah, you know, that's correct, Dave. And literally everything was on the line. And basically the same thing happened that cost us the belts on the TV match in this other match here that we were in. So the Big C and the Mongolian Stomper, they got involved again. They'd been involved in the TV match. It helped Bass and Rose to win the championships. And now we get a bad deal on the return match and this last shot match in the arena. So when we showed the video of how that happened, all four of them involved against us again for the TV studio, they exploded in boos. It's like they hadn't seen this match. So they were like, wow, what a rotten deal they got. So Charlie asked if we'd like to stay at the set and watch the first TV match of the day. So Rob and I, you know, we were a little upset. Well, we're actually very upset about what's going on here. And we said, well, who's in it? And he said, you're going to see some guys you're familiar with, right? So we kind of figured out real quick, well, about who we're about to see. And we declined, you know. We told him, no, we'd just as soon go back to the dressing room. So Charlie asked him to ring the bell for the first TV match.
Okay, so who was in that first TV match?
the Big C and the Mongolian Stomper were in that match. And, you know, we're going to end up wrestling them, you know, because we wanted to. And, wow, man, did they get a nasty reception. I mean, when they came out, the fans booed them like crazy. Big C never got in the ring for the match. We didn't have to. I mean, his Mongolian Stomper took care of business as few wrestlers could. I mean, you know, you couldn't have a better partner than that. And so Big C just stood out there on the apron and, you know, smiled and laughed and giggled and had a good time. And as soon as the match ended, Big C and the Stomper immediately got out of the ring. They went to the set and they got a roar of boos. I mean, fans weren't happy with their win, for sure. And so Big C started screaming right off the bat at Charlie. You know, he says, I know you have another video to show. You know, they had shown we had shown the first one about how they had robbed us in the arena. And he said, I know you got another video to show with my Stomper and I and those against those Fuller punks. He always called us the Fuller punks. And so and he said, I'm sure, Charlie Platt, that you can't wait to show it. And he said, but I forbid it. yeah, Charlie doesn't care for that type of stuff, you know, right. Especially for Big C. He had a problem with it. And so Charlie answered him, and he had a really good answer. He said, you know, he said, we were planning to run that video later in the show. And he says, but since you forbid me from showing it, he said, I think it's the perfect time to run it right now. So he called for the director to run the video. And, wow, the studio crowd popped, you know, because Big C, he went crazy. You know, he pushed his Stomper toward the dressing room, you know, and he shouted back at Charlie. He was taking his Stomper out of there. He didn't want to see it. He didn't want anything to do with it. And he screamed back at Charlie. He says, you're going to pay for this, Charlie Platt. You know, so I don't know. I don't remember Charlie ever having to pay for it. But,
right.
You know, it's pretty easy for Big C to make those type of threats. So Rob and I saw that they were going to change the order for the video on the format. And so we wanted to be there for this video, basically. And so we went back to the set real quick. And about the time we got there, the video was just beginning when we got to the set. And so the video showed the wild ending to the Southeastern match from the week before, between the champion Mongolian Stomper and the former champion Bob Armstrong. It was Stomper and Armstrong's match, but this match turned into be something involving a lot of people. So as this continued, a wrestler after wrestler started entering the ring. There's a wild melee on the end of this match, and the first guy to go into the ring, first was Big C got involved in the match, and then Joe LeDuc came down to the ring. And then pretty soon after Joe LeDuc got there, Ron Bass and Randy Rose both came down to the ring. And they started then basically, that was 4-on-2. That you had Bass and Rose and you had Stomper and you had Big C. And there was just Bob and Joe LeDuc. And they were pretty much taking them to task, man. They were whooping the heck out of them. And so Rob and I, we go down. And we were the last ones to enter the ring, and that kind of evened out the numbers. So you know, by that time, Bass and Rose were kind of going at it with Joe LeDuc and Bob, and me and Rob, we didn't care. We went straight for Big C and Stomper, because we had just had that happen to us where they had stolen the belts from us and put us in a position where we're never going to have a chance to win the titles again. And so they cost us our belt and that chance to win the titles again. And so Rob pile-drived Big C, pile-drived him twice. And I saw him pile-drive him the first time, and I got Stomper in a position. I pile-drive Stomper, and then I went ahead and pile-drive Stomper twice. And so Bob and Joe, they got their hands, you know, hands raised for the first time. On Bass and Rose, and Big C and Stomper, they got carried back to the dressing room on stretchers. And the studio crowd loved that video, especially the last part.
I bet they did. No wonder Big C didn't want that shown on TV. I noticed right before the break when you were running down the next card that you and Robert were in a special challenge tag match the upcoming week against the Mongolian Stomper and Big C. That was a unique way to open this TV show. So who is in the next TV match?
Well, you had the newcomer, the guy that I had never seen before he arrived, Tom Stanton. And he had that great 20-minute time limit draw match with Charlie Cook that I stood and watched in Mobile. And wow, it was his first week in the territory. He had people standing up at the end of the match. So Charlie Cook joined Charlie Platt at the set. He wanted to watch the TV match, and he was very complimentary. Tom Stanton was going to be in the ring. So, you know, Charlie invited Charlie Cook. He wanted to watch him. He was complimentary. He told it like it was. He said, "This guy's great. He's got real potential, man." You know, and so they were going to be returning in the next week's card on the 30-minute time limit match. And Stanton, boy, got himself a strong win. First TV match. I guess it was about a 6 or 8 minute match. But he used three different suplexes back to back.
Wow.
Before he pinned the guy. This guy was off to a good start.
Wow. All right. So take us to the personality profile. Who was on that?
Well, the two men that were going to face each other for the opportunity to wrestle the World Junior Heavyweight Champion, Les Thornton, who was from England, just like Tony Charles was. And that was going to take place the following week. So Tony Charles and Jerry Stubbs were on the set with Charlie at the same time. And Charlie made sure, you know, and he right off the bat that these two guests were not going to have a problem on the set. And Stubbs maintained his cool for a change. And so they opened up the profile with a fantastic highlight reel from England with Les Thornton. And during that thing, man, Les Thornton beat some of the best junior heavyweight wrestlers in the world. I recognized a lot of the guys. And the last guy he beat in this highlight reel was Danny Hodge. Danny Hodge was one of the greatest of all time. So neither Rob and I or anybody else on our TV dressing room except Tony Charles was even familiar with Les Thornton. You know, Les Thornton was kind of new to us and new to America. So this reel of wins by Thornton was spectacular, man. And it made us all want to watch this guy in action. You know, I was like, son of a gun, I can't wait to see this. So Stubbs, even though he had grown to be so egotistic after 7 weeks undefeated as the U.S. junior champion, he was blown away what he'd seen. And he had to admit, he goes, "Charlie, that guy's good." And he wasn't good, he was great, you know. So when you were watching world champions beat opponent after opponent in the way this guy did, it had to bring you down to earth pretty quick, man. And Stubbs was no exception. He was like, "Wow, I don't know, right?" But Tony Charles had a totally different view of Les Thornton, and because he had wrestled him as champion many times in England. And he had two victories and beat him twice in the last 5 years. He had beaten Les Thornton. So all before Les Thornton had become champion, he had these matches and several of them, you know. And so Tony's problem was that the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion was the guy that was going to get the shot. And if he didn't beat Jerry Stubbs, he wasn't going to get to wrestle Les Thornton, even though he had beaten him before. So both Charles and Stubbs, you know, they handled themselves very well during this extremely interesting personality profile. And at the end of it, they actually shook hands and they wished each other luck in the upcoming match to see who was going to get the shot at the World Junior Heavyweight Champion.
Okay, so that to me, that personality profile was much different than what I had expected, but very interesting to say the least. Maybe these world title matches brought out the best in their opponents. So take us to the next segment on the TV show.
As a tribute to how great a talent we had during this time frame, Ricky Gibson had been there for 2 months. This was going to be his second time on TV in 2 months because we had so many great guys. We couldn't get them all on. And he was going to be facing on the next card in the arena, Plowboy Frazier. And Plowboy and Floyd, they joined Charlie at the set to watch his match. I don't know that these guys got a lot of credit, but these Pensacola boys, I used to call them the Pensacola boys, the Pensacola Gibson brothers. They were extremely good wrestlers. Ricky, which is the oldest, was in his prime at this point. Mm-hmm. And his little brother, Robert, had a phenomenal career ahead of him, man. He's going to be part of the Rock and Roll Express, one of the greatest tag teams of all time.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, these Gibson boys were talented, good boys. So, my boy at the set with Charlie had lost to Joe LeDuc the week before, but he didn't get beat by him in the ring. He left the ring with Joe LeDuc in it, and he got counted out. He just went to the dressing room because Joe LeDuc was going to kick his butt big time. So Plowboy didn't want to talk about that, you know, as much as he was going to do. He spent the time at the set with Charlie talking about Ricky Gibson and what he was going to do to Ricky Gibson this next week. Yeah. And about the time he got to running his mouth really good, Ricky Gibson crawled up on the top rope and he drop kicked the guy's head off. It was like, and that shut his mouth. I mean, Plowboy didn't know what to say after that. I think he said to Charlie, did he drop kick him on the top rope? I'm thinking me and Rob, we laughed like crazy. He drop kicked his brains out is what he did. So
wow,
it was a good match.
Wow. Okay. I wanted to mention, and if fans have not, Studcast fans have not seen the picture from last week's episode, it's Andre the Giant and the Plowboy standing face to face. And I kind of gasped when I saw it. I thought, this guy was absolutely huge. And that's saying a lot when he's standing face to face with Andre the Giant. How tall do you think he was?
Oh, he was 6'10". He was 6'10", and he weighed about 430 pounds. And those two guys standing face to face, there wasn't much difference in them.
No.
Height-wise nor body-wise. You know, he was just about as big as Andre.
Yeah, it's that photo, if you haven't seen that from last week's episode, this is episode 363. Go back to 362 last week. Not only if you haven't heard the episode, you got to hear it too. But check out that picture because that is phenomenal with this Plowboy standing face to face with the legendary Andre the Giant. And as you said, only inches between them. All right, so take us to the last TV match, Stud.
Well, last match was the tag team match, you know, and they had wrestled together in one match in their history, this team that were about to be in this match. And that was in a double bull rope match, which was a month earlier. So Bob Armstrong and Joe LeDuc were going to be a team. One of the first times ever for them in their history to be a team. And when they left the dressing room, they didn't go to the ring. They went straight to the bleachers, man, where the crowd, where the fans was, and they were mobbed. I mean, wow, what a great start to that. The other team finally came to the ring. It didn't make any difference. Those two guys were just loved by the fans. So in the week ahead, they were going to get their first shot ever at a Southeastern Tag Championship. They'd only wrestled together in the one bull rope match. So this was a chance to win the Southeastern Championship. And the Big C kept his champions in the dressing room. Made a point of not getting those guys out there until LeDuc and Armstrong got in the ring and they rang the bell. Then he brought his team, his championship team, to the set with Les, you know. And so he trotted him out to the set in there with Charlie, and he asked Charlie why his team. Hey, Big C was he was a trip, you know. Him and Charlie had already had a little problem anyway, and he asked Charlie. He says, "I want you to explain to me, Charlie Platt, why my team has to wrestle two seriously deranged people like Joe LaDuke and Bob Armstrong." So Charlie wasn't going to be outdone by him, you know. So, and he turned it around on him real quick. So he said, "No, I want to ask you something." He said, "I want to ask you, why you and the Mongolian Stomper interfered in the last two championship matches with the Fuller Brothers against Ron Bass and Randy Rhoads." and then he says that if that had not happened, he said, you wouldn't be wrestling against Bob Armstrong and Joe Duke. And he goes, "And you should really think now," he goes, "now you got a real problem, because," he says, "they're going to take your belts away from your boys, the ones that are now wearing right there."
He always had a comeback.
Yeah, he said, now your boys are going to have to wrestle against Bob Armstrong and Joe LaDuke. You know, you should have left things alone, basically, you know. So Big C, he went ballistic. I mean, he blew up then, and he started screaming at Charlie that he, you know, but then he saw Armstrong about that time put the sleeper hold on one of the guys that they were wrestling in the ring, and at about the same time Joe LaDuke put the bear hug on the other one. And he saw that this is over, right? And he hustled his champions back to the dressing room before Bob and Joe could get their hands raised, because he was afraid they may get their hands on his boys before he wanted them to.
Hey, that's the kind of TV show we loved back then. What a great one. And, I mean, so many new things going on. So take us to the arenas, because all of this was set up for the big arena shows the following week.
Well, Norvell Lawson beat Sweet Brown Sugar. Great match. Both those guys were so good. Ricky Gibson and Plowboy Frazier, who was seconded by Floyd, they wrestled to a 20-minute time limit draw. Plowboy was a hard guy to beat. I mean, he was so big, and Ricky's wasn't a huge guy. And, wow, Ricky was so fast compared to Plowboy. Fans loved that match. It was absolutely, it was amazing to watch. The 30-minute time limit match between Charlie Cook and the newcomer, Tom Stanton, it ended in another draw. The 30-minute time limit ran out this time rather than 20-minute. So, I watched that and I said, let's put them back together again, make it no time limit. Let's see who can beat who in this thing. So then the next week, that's what they were going to be coming back in. The United States Junior Heavyweight Championship match between champion Jerry Stubbs and Tony Charles, with the winner, was supposed to get the World Junior title shot the following week against Les Thornton. Their match ended up in a double disqualification, and there was no winner. It's like, wow, what do you do now? And, so we had to think about that one some. Then there was a special challenge match between Rob and I against Stomper and the Big C. That match ended up in a heck of a brawl, man. All four of us ended up bleeding, and the match got stopped. There was no winner in it, and it was going to be coming back. We were coming back the next week for this big event in the main arena, which we really loved to get to, because we kept selling out that expo hall, couldn't put enough people in there. So we were going to be in the Mobile Arena the next week. We were going to come back, wrestle them in a Texas Death Tornado match. All four of us in the ring, Texas Death Match rules. So then the last match was the Southeastern Tag Championship with the champions, Ron Bass, Randy Rhoads, managed by the Big C. They were wrestling against Armstrong and Joe LaDuke. And this match was won by Bob and Joe, but it was by disqualification. Now, obviously, Big C didn't allow his boys to get beat. Mm-hmm. He'd rather see them get disqualified. And if they're going to lose, he didn't want them to lose the belt, and he made that happen.
Yeah, that sounds like the Big C right there. All right, so how about the attendances in the three major cities on this one? for the second week in August of 1980?
Well, let's see. I mean, Montgomery had 4,600 people. It had been, it had some crowds in that 5,000 range. So it was still up there, very strong. Dothan was almost the same as the week before, just slightly below 5,000 in Dothan. Mobile, it was the usual deal. Sold out, 5,600 people, turned away some again. And like I said, next week we're going to be in that 10,000 seat Mobile main arena. So we were looking forward to that.
Okay, so I know fans have been eagerly waiting on some more stories about you and Kevin Sullivan, because you knew him for such a long time. So we've been talking about keeping his memory alive, and I think that is how you had planned to end today's Studcast.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, you know, we're not going to have time. I don't want to get into this and have us trying to get into a learning tree question. So, I'm gonna talk. I think I'm gonna be able to. I'll have to watch and see where we don't run too long here, Dave. But that's my intentions. I want to end this show basically with Kevin Sullivan. So thankfully, we did some time in my first tribute to Kevin 2 weeks ago, two Studcasts ago, and I talked about an angle Kevin and I worked on together. It was with his New Guinea headhunter team that when he came to work for me in 1986 and 87, he had this team, man, and we had and where we talked about an angle where they had a third headhunter and we had a cage match, and the third headhunter had sat under the ring for 4 hours before the crowd came in and the matches all went on and nobody knew he was there. And then when the cage match started at the right point, Kevin buzzed him under the ring and he took a knife and cut his way up through the mat and, pushed one of the big boards of the plywood out of the middle of the ring. And obviously he made his dramatic, I would have called a dramatic appearance, man.
No doubt.
Third headhunter. And there was no third headhunter until he came and did this. So that match happened in 1986. But there was another match 10 years before that one in 1976 that involved Kevin and his father. When Kevin had come to me to wrestle for me the first time in Southeastern in Knoxville. In 1976, he came there, and Kevin had told me about an angle that he and his dad had worked in Roy Shire's territory in San Francisco in the Cow Palace 2 years earlier, which would have been about 1974, 75. So, Kevin had said that, you know, this angle was really good, Ron, So Kevin was in a program basically with a heel that, and I don't remember the name of the heel that he was working with, but he had his father fly from Boston to San Francisco, and he had his father sit in his corner. It was a very important night for Kevin, and obviously they had a good program going, him and this heel, and now he gets his father involved. So he's, and I don't know, maybe the heel had a manager. I don't know how that went down, but I do know that Kevin's father got Kevin was in a similar situation in my Knoxville territory. He was working with one of our hot heels, and he had been in a long program. So Kevin's father got hurt, in this match in San Francisco. It wasn't supposed to happen, but he got injured. And his father had flown from Boston to San Francisco. So Kevin, I don't remember who the heel was that was working in Knoxville, but we did a similar angle to what they had done in California. Kevin had his father come, and Kevin was just starting to get over big time. And he was at a point where he needed a situation similar to this, to get over. And you know, and since his dad had done this for him before, it made sense for it to happen again. So in the dressing room before the match, we talked about what was supposed to happen in the match before. And at some point in that conversation, I got called away to you know, if you were booking and you were, you know, you didn't have a chance to spend much time with anybody. And I got called away for some reason. And Kevin and his father and the heel that was in this match, we had talked about what was supposed to happen. Well, they decided they were going to add to it. So they made this finish much more dangerous than it was going to be. And his father got hurt really badly in this angle.
Wow.
So it showed me not only was Kevin's father's commitment to the business big time, but it was also his father's love and commitment to Kevin that I was just struck by, man. I mean, his dad just loved him. It was amazing, you know. And when I paid the wrestlers that night after the match was over and his father was hurt, you know, and I apologized, and, you know, and Kevin felt bad because, you know, I didn't want that to have happened. And it did. And so I paid both of them. You know, I never considered not paying his father, obviously, for what, you know, he'd done all this for his son. Mm-hmm. Basically, he came and did this for his son and didn't know he was going to get injured, but he did. So I paid Kevin's father. I paid Kevin's father more than I paid Kevin because he got hurt. Kevin didn't. And I felt like he deserved it. So it was years later before Kevin set me down one night and, you know, and he said, you know, he said, I want to talk to you about you paying my dad in Knoxville. And I was like, well, geez, what do you expect? And he said, Ron, he says, when my dad came to San Francisco and he worked that angle and he got injured a little bit, he said, they paid my father nothing. They didn't give him anything for coming and doing the deal, you know. And they said he just paid me, you know. And then he said I felt horrible because he got hurt. And he said, you know, he said my father was so impressed with the fact that you not only paid him, but when we talked about how much he paid you, you paid him. You paid him more than you paid me, right? So Kevin retold this story many times, and I think he told this story to no telling how many people about the difference in promoters, I guess, and the way people handle business. And he always liked to bring it up, and I was like, oh, Kevin, you don't need to talk about that again, you know, but he was so taken by what had happened.
Wow. So that's a wonderful story. I mean, do you have any others to share with us? I know there's so many events in your life and in your relationship with Kevin Sullivan.
Well, you know, I talked a little bit about the time he and I spent together in the Florida Keys in the 1990s. I talked about that in the last tribute. And he was doing the booking in the 1990s for Ted Turner and for the huge WCW wrestling company in Atlanta. He was their booker. And according to my brother, he was, you know, and my brother was managing people at this time. And this is kind of crazy. My brother was managing Sid Vicious, one of the guys, Sid Vicious.
Wow.
And Kevin was the booker for that company when Rob was managing Sid Vicious. And, you know, so, it was an outlandish amount of money he was being paid as the booker. So, and then Kevin, I think I mentioned this in the last tribute, Kevin lived in Key Largo, which was only 10 miles away from Tavernier in the Keys where I live. And we didn't even know it for 2 years that we were just that close to one another, you know. And just about every time I saw him after that, you know, he asked me about doing some booking with him, you know. And I was retired at this point. And, you know, I'd spent some years in the hockey business. I'd sold both my teams. And, you know, I wasn't looking to do anything. I didn't want to get back involved in wrestling, you know. But Kevin was like, well, gosh, Ron, you know, man, you got such a mind for the business. And, you know, he said, I'll pay you. And, you know, pay you good money, man, if you just, you know, talk to me, man. They help me create ideas and create the angles and stuff. So I watched their TV show, pretty much every week because my brother was on it. And, you know, a lot of guys that I knew were on it. And but I never let him talk me into going back to the wrestling business. So, you know, he asked me about it. Really often. So
wow.
I got one more story here.
All right.
And this one is about, this was another one that he kept asking me the same thing for quite a lot. And, when I started my first Southeastern Wrestling Company in Knoxville, he didn't come to wrestle for me until 1978. First 4 years, there was no Kevin. He never asked. He never called. And I knew he was doing good. And so I didn't try to attract him, but then he finally did call me, and I brought him in 1978. That's about the time that his father got hurt in the same time frame. And I remember the first time Kevin rode with me, and we went to wrestle in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. We went from Knoxville to Gatlinburg, which is only about 30 miles, but it's one of the most beautiful 30 miles. That you can imagine, you know, if you've not been in that part of the country, it was a beautiful part of the country. Wow. And so there was a big a viewing site, you know, where you could pull off the road up there around Gatlinburg. And so we pulled over in the site, and it was absolutely spectacular. And Kevin had just kind of got there, you know, and he says, he asked me, he said, Ron, he goes, Ronald, he always called me Ronald. He says, Ronald, he goes, how did you find this place? He said, it's so beautiful. And I told him, I had a simple answer. I didn't say much. I said, Kevin, it's God's country. So about 8 years later, in the 1980s, I'm living in Pensacola. And I got Southeastern has turned into Continental. It's a much bigger territory. He calls me, and I bring him in again. You know, and I remember first day I went to the beach with him. You know, and wow, and that Pensacola beach is so white. The sand was so white. I mean, it burned. You had to wear sunglasses. You couldn't see
because
And the water was so crystal clear and blue. And, you know, we stood on the edge of the water there, and he looked at me, and he goes, Ronald, he goes, how did you find this place? same line, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he said, it's so beautiful, you know. And so I just said the same thing as I'd said before, years earlier, and in another whole decade earlier, you know, I said, it's God's country, you know?
Yeah.
And, so then in the 1990s, another 10 years later, another decade later, we stood on the back of my boat in the Florida Keys, and, we were looking down at lobsters. You can see them 20 feet deep crawling around on the bottom. And he turned to me and he says, Ronald, how did you find this place? and again, I said, you know, it was a common line at this point. I said, it's God's
country. Wow.
So I'm gonna leave this subject, you know, and with a very personal thought. You know, and I think back on this, especially when Kevin died, about God's country. And so, you know, I have a kid, got seven nuts. I kind of think about Kevin. When I think about Kevin now, I see him, man, standing in heaven, looking down and smiling. And I think he's finally found, man, the real God's country.
Wow. Just wow. All right. As always, this has been a fantastic studcast. You have taken us to Birmingham, Alabama, to Knoxville, Tennessee, and to the southeastern Gulf Coast to talk wrestling. And you closed out with your feelings about a very special person to you. Many times, these studcasts are so much more than wrestling. And today, definitely one of those times. Kevin Sullivan is one for me as a young boy. I mean, as a boy, he was one of the first wrestlers I knew of and could call by name. So, man, that was an awesome experience spending this time on this studcast. All right, so where do we ride on the next studcast?
Well, we're going to be returning to Tennessee for another look at their next Knoxville card. We're going to kind of see what and why they're having all these different problems, and are they ever going to find success there? When we get to the southeastern Gulf Coast territory, it's going to be the same week as the Tennessee territory next week again. And we're going to have a very rare situation, man, that happened here that's going to require a dramatic change to a card. First of all, we had this match in which the junior heavyweight champion is going to get to wrestle the world junior heavyweight champion. And there's no winner in that match. So there's kind of a problem that has developed there. And on top of that problem is a second problem that happens. So we're going to talk about the wrestling business and how you never knew what to expect or how to plan things. So we're going to talk about that situation next week. I think it'll be hopefully we can have a learning tree question maybe next podcast.
You know what? You get a pass on the learning tree on this week because the relationship story with Kevin Sullivan was just off the charts. Hey, folks, it's so easy to get up with Ron and communicate with the Tennessee Stud. Find Ron at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, on Facebook. Like and follow him there. Automatically become friends with a living legend. Twitter or X, it's the same thing. Ron Fuller Welch, follow him there, too. Check out the fantastic website, tnstud.com. This studcast is going to be there with every studcast ever done. The Stud Store is where you can get 43 super studcasts, 4 different 8x10 photos, the best-selling novel called Brutus, personally autographed to you. You can subscribe to the YouTube channel, Southeastern Rewind. Southeastern Rewind on YouTube. Find hundreds of hours of classic old-school wrestling entertainment. 438 total videos. The last 141 studcast, Ask the Stud shows, and Short Rides with the Stud. Go back 1 year or more and discover fantastic stud stories with worldwide stars. Studcast archive stories, Tell Me More fan question shows, superstars of the past, and so much more. YouTube, Southeastern Rewind. It is the best deal in wrestling. All right. Any final words, Ron?
Well, yeah, I'd like to thank everybody, man, for listening today again, as always. And we appreciate your continued support here. Please take care of yourselves and others, and may God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me on Facebook at facebook.com/dsummers955. That's Summers with an O, SOMMERS. And on Twitter, also known as X, Dave_Doin on Twitter. On Instagram, it's Instagram.com, David Summers Productions. And hit me up anytime at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This Studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud
LLC. Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud. This is David Summers saying so long from the great Smoky Mountains.